This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you live in a small town in Vermont, chances are your fire department is a volunteer one. There are about 235 volunteer fire departments around the state, and they're filled by more than 5,000 local people who've agreed to dedicate a significant amount of time to getting trained and responding at a moment's notice to an emergency in their town. I should disclose that my husband is on the squad in our town. But there are challenges these departments face. Recruitment, retainment, fundraising for new gear and equipment, ongoing training and educational opportunities. Plus the issue of having a volunteer department staffed by people with other day jobs, jobs that are sometimes far away from town or ones that they're unable to leave if something pops up in the middle of the day. Today on the program, we'll talk about the challenges facing small volunteer fire departments and about why people choose to become firefighters and support their communities in this way. You can tell us why you did or what questions you have about how the departments work. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And I'm joined for this discussion today by Brett LaRose, president of the Addison County Firefighters Association and chief of the Bristol Fire Department. Brett, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Why did you want to become a firefighter?
Family tradition. My older brother, he joined about a year before I did, and he talked it up. Back then, 20-plus years ago, there was a waiting list to join the fire department. And he said, you got to come on down and check this out. It's really exciting. And I did. I became a member of the Bristol Fire Department April 5th, 1995. So actually tomorrow is my 21st anniversary, 21 years with the department.
And, happy anniversary.
Thank you. And it's been a fun ride ever since.
Why choose to become a volunteer firefighter then and not a career firefighter?
Well, I chose to live in a small rural community, and now raising a family in a small rural community. I have family values. I like the small town atmosphere, and I was raised with values where you always give back to your community. And what a great way to give back to your community, to protect and to serve the citizens in which you share that town with.
From your experience now with more than 20 years with the fire department and leading the Addison County Firefighters Association, what do you think motivates most people who join their local departments?
I think a lot of the same. You see generation after generation of firefighters coming through the ranks, people who move in to their communities and want to give back something. But really, I believe that's the primary reason, just people wanting to give back. And it's a great way to spend your free time, if you have any.
You do see a lot of generational firefighters, like you mentioned that you were, people who you can tell, you know, there's a lot of similar last names on the same department, or people whose dads did it, and so they've joined as, you know, young adults themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm third generation in my family. I've had a great uncle who served for 63 years, longest serving member of the Bristol Fire Department. My grandfather, my uncle were both chiefs, so I'm third generation chief of the Bristol Fire Department, and I'm honored to be able to say that.
What about the sense of heroism or romanticism that comes along with firefighting, especially for young recruits and young members? You must get some of that.
Absolutely. And I think initially that's a lot of it. That's what gets people hitched. You know, the excitement of running into that burning building, all the tools and equipment we get to utilize, the red lights, the sirens, you know, those are what draw a young person, no doubt about it. But until you actually get into it and find out, it's a lot more than that. It's the, as you mentioned, the fundraising, the meetings every month, the regular trainings, the continuing education. The list goes on and on of everything you have to do as a volunteer firefighter.
Now, you're the chief of the Bristol department, so there's even more responsibility on your shoulders. But how much time do you think it takes out of a normal person's month?
Out of a normal or average, or let's say a firefighter's person, they maybe don't necessarily hold a position within the department, 8 to 10 hours a month. When you take regularly scheduled trainings, scheduled meetings, incidents, you know, emergencies happen when they happen. And depending on your availability, you know, what time of day is the call? Are you available? Are you at another commitment? But yeah, I'd say on an average 10 hours a month per firefighter.
We got a note from Michael in Middlebury who says, the reality is that actual fires make up a very small part of a volunteer firefighter's job these days. Most of our calls deal with other hazards like car accidents, trees and wires down, water and ice rescues, and just about any other situation you could think of. While it is undeniably a good thing that fires happen less frequently today than they did in the past, it does make it more difficult for volunteer firefighters to develop effective firefighting skills, and it can also impact the retention of personnel. Do you agree with that comment?
I do agree with that comment. When someone has an emergency, you know, however they define that, they pick up the phone and they call 911. And if it's not something that requires, let's say, law enforcement, the fire department's being dispatched, or you know, the local rescue squad or first response organization. But yes, motor vehicle crashes, lines down, assisting with mountain rescues or floods when they happen in your community. I mean, if you don't know who to call, they call the fire department, because typically we have the resources to handle the situation, or have the resources or the personnel who are able to find the resources to help mitigate that particular situation or emergency.
What kind of training goes into becoming a fully fledged member of a department?
So in the state of Vermont, state statute states that the authority having jurisdiction, which usually is the fire chief, they actually set the training standards for their individual department. I can only speak specifically for Bristol, but we require all of our new personnel to go through the NFPA's standards for professional qualifications as a firefighter. NFPA 1001 is the standard.
And this is a national organization, so these are national firefighting
standards.
These
are national standards, correct. And that course is offered annually in Addison County, and it's about 200 hours in length.
And what do firefighters learn how to do in that course?
Fundamental firefighting skills, from fire suppression, fire suppression, basic first aid skills, CPR, assisting special rescue teams, just understanding your role as a firefighter on the fire scene. What are you going to do? You know, hand tools. We are exposed to so many different types of emergencies and have to be well-versed in so many types of – how to use so many different types of tools and pieces of equipment.
So some of it is book learning. You know, it's like a course that you'd take with a textbook. And then some of it is also sort of in situ learning, where you have to actually do a sort of a regulated simulation of what a fire would be like.
That's correct. So the course meets every Thursday night. It's basically two college semesters. It begins in September, take a little break for the holidays, and they wrap up in April or May. 3 to 4 hours every Thursday night, and I believe it's 8 practical days that typically take place at the Vermont Fire Academy down in Pittsford, Vermont, to practice those skills you have learned in the classroom.
Diane wants to know what the requirements are to be a volunteer firefighter, which you just talked about, including physical strength and endurance and age range. So are there are physical fitness tests that you have to pass, and there actually are age requirements as well?
For the Bristol Fire Department, again, I mean, to join the fire department, you need to be a minimum of 18 years of age and graduated from high school or obtained a GED. But as long as you can meet the physical requirements of the job, we certainly don't discriminate when it comes to age.
And do you have to keep those physical fitness requirements up? I mean, do you have to pass a test every year to say you're still fit, or can you pass those requirements when you're 19 and then, you know, at 40 it would be a harder thing to do?
Again, I can only speak for the town of Bristol when it comes to this, but there are many different jobs to do in the fire service, you know, whether it be fire suppression, attacking the fire, you're the person with that self-contained breathing apparatus on your back, going into that burning building, you know, possibly performing a rescue, or there may be those who are only interested in driving the fire apparatus, or, you know, less strenuous tasks on the fire ground. So, for those who want to wear a self-contained breathing apparatus, we put our firefighters annually through a physical ability course it's kind of a measuring stick. It's not really a pass-fail. It's just kind of where you can personally evaluate yourself and where you're at, and a chance for the officers just to look at that individual's skills.
Tell me a little bit more. Put me into a fire situation where somebody is going to be fully kitted out in their gear and have that oxygen tank attached to them. What that feels like to wear that equipment and to go into a burning structure, for example.
So the equipment, if you're wearing a full ensemble of turnout gear with self-contained breathing apparatus, you're looking at about 75 pounds of gear. And just to kind of put it in terms that, you know, the person who's not in the fire service would understand, it's kind of like wearing a big bulky snowsuit. You know, it's cumbersome. You don't move that well. It's not that flexible, but it's designed to protect you from obviously the heat, from tears. It's built in different layers, but it's a very, very cumbersome just to wear that equipment.
And when you go into a structure, what do you experience? I mean, every fire is different.
Every fire is different, but you know, thinking kind of worst case scenario, you go into an environment, the temperatures are elevated, perhaps little to no visibility. You're relying on your teammates, your fellow firefighters, the skills you learned in that basic firefighting course and that you continue to develop each year. That's what you rely on when you get in those situations to ultimately get yourself out, be safe, and go home.
We got that note from Diane, who had questions about eligibility, and she also wondered, do these volunteers ever get paid for their work? And in some cases, some volunteers are paid.
Yes. Some communities, depending on if they're part of their municipality or not, may be compensated a small stipend when they go out for the actual emergency. Some communities may actually be paid for training, certain types of training, but it all depends on your individual town's fire department, your operating budget, which perhaps your select board and ultimately your taxpayers approve. But in Bristol, we do receive a small stipend when that alarm goes off.
What is the stipend? I mean, we're not talking about millions of dollars.
It's not even minimum wage. So essentially, you're paid approximately $9 an hour. So you might get a couple hundred dollars a year. You get paid once a year, and it's a little something to say thank you.
We're talking today about volunteer firefighters in Vermont, more than 5,000 of them in the state in more than 235 departments. If you are a volunteer and want to share your experiences, why you joined the department, what you feel like you get out of it, or what the challenges are for recruitment, training, retainment, fundraising, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Mary who says, yesterday I saw fire trucks and orange cones at CVU's parking lot, CVU being Champlain Valley Union High School. I'm guessing the fire department volunteers were practicing how to maneuver the fire trucks, and Mary says, it looked like fun, serious fun. Thank you, all fire department volunteers. We count on you. Be safe. And Katie in Grand Isle says, in 2012, the home we were renting burned down in a complete loss. Thankfully, my husband, our two kids, and I, we weren't home. We lost everything, including our two cats and our puppy. The volunteer firefighters in Grand Isle and the surrounding stations were amazing. They were so compassionate and caring. They attempted multiple times to find our dog's crate so we could bury him, but they couldn't safely get to him. So again, you can share your thoughts at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. And let's get another voice into the conversation here. Jacob Giles is a member of the New Haven Volunteer Fire Department. He's also a member of the department in Potsdam, New York, where he's a freshman at Clarkson University. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm great. And I'm curious about your motivations. What made you want to be a volunteer firefighter?
Well, it was a combination of things. As Brett mentioned earlier, there's a certain romance associated with being a volunteer firefighter. I admit that was part of it, being an 18-year-old male. Another part of it is definitely I enjoy serving my community and giving back. That's one of the big values I have when it comes to firefighting.
So when you say giving back, what is it that you vocalize what you feel like you're doing for your community by being a firefighter?
That's a good question. It's several things. I feel that one aspect is, as a firefighter, we bring the community together through our fundraising events, whether it's a pancake breakfast or a chicken barbecue. And that's pretty much the main way for me, yes.
So you've joined not only the New Haven department when you're home, but now that you're away at college, you've joined the Potsdam department. Do you find that there are real differences in either culture or training or the way the departments operate between the two?
There, as far as training goes, it's pretty much the same. We still have to adhere to the same standards, the NFPA. But in Potsdam, since we're dealing with several colleges, we average about 525 calls a year. Last month we had about 61 calls. So it's a higher call volume. We stay a lot busier. It's nice because it's easier to retain those skills that you learn in Firefighter One. But other than that, the brotherhood, the camaraderie is still very much the same.
Jacob, does firefighting fit into your future career goals in one way or another?
Yes, it does. I guess I should say it depends how important it is to you. And no matter what job you have, you can always make it work. Whether it be, you can just take a separate job on the department, whether it be secretary or firefighter. But it will work for me as a mechanical engineering student. I can see it working for me in the future.
So you think you'll continue to be a volunteer firefighter, not a career firefighter, but it's going to be something that you fit into your life?
Yeah, definitely. I'm the first generation volunteer firefighter for my family, so I'd still like to pass it on to my kids and let them see what it's like.
Jacob Giles is a member of the New Haven Volunteer Fire Department, as I mentioned, also the Potsdam, New York Department, and he's a freshman at Clarkson University. Jacob, thank you for talking with us and sharing your experience.
Thank you.
We're learning a little bit about what motivates people to become firefighters as volunteers for their local towns. As I said, more than 5,000 of them just in Vermont. And the basic training is a 200-hour course, so it's not without commitment, not to mention the calls in the middle of the night or whenever they occur that people have to go to. If you have an experience to share or a question about some of the challenges, coming up we're going to talk a little bit more about training beyond Firefighter One, beyond the basic course, talk a little bit about fundraising, and maybe look ahead to, is this the same system we'll have in the future? What's changing about how our volunteer fire departments are organized around the state? You can share your perspective. 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're looking at the challenges faced by Vermont's volunteer fire departments and why firefighters decide to do it. You can share your experiences by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with Brett LaRose, president of the Addison County Firefighters Association. He's also chief of the Bristol Fire Department. We got a note from Patricia in Newark who says, in Newark, one volunteer by all reports saved my neighbor's life when the ambulance was en route. He wasn't on duty, but he heard the emergency on the scanner. We are one of Vermont's smallest towns and in a very rural area. How lucky we are to have him and the skilled volunteer fire department here. Chris in Starksboro says, as a third-generation career fire lieutenant, my hat goes off to the men and women who protect my home, family, and neighbors when I'm busy at my job protecting the taxpayers in the city, where our call volume is about 7,500 calls a year. Thank you and stay safe. And Michael says, in order to preserve the volunteer departments, I would suggest that the state compensate them for their continuing mandates on training and equipment by offering volunteer firefighters a rebate on their state taxes, perhaps a rate of $25 per hour served for either fighting fire or training. Brett, you have to do your own taxes or somebody does your taxes. So there you can get some special compensation for some of the things related to volunteering, like mileage and other things like that. Would something like Michael's suggestion work, do you think?
I've certainly heard those conversations in the past. It certainly would be a nice benefit, perhaps more incentive. As we're talking a little bit about recruitment and retention, how do you continue to recruit the next generation of volunteer firefighters to protect our small rural communities? And that certainly would be an incentive.
So in terms of training, we talked a little bit about the basic national standards that most departments in the state, I think, adhere to, that to be a fully fledged member of the department, you need to pass Firefighter One, the safety and training course. But there is also ongoing training. What kinds of things do firefighters learn in these ongoing monthly or weekly sessions that they're supposed to be gaining experience from?
Sure. In any profession, there's continuing education. After you finish that basic firefighting course, that 200-hour course, you need to keep those skills sharp and you need to build upon them. each community is different. They have different types of businesses to protect, school systems to protect. You know, what is in your community? And, you know, this is where pre-planning comes into play. You know, what can you do as a department to better protect the community you live in? You know, perhaps there's some unique types of manufacturing there, you know, working with those businesses. So when that alarm does come in, you're better prepared to protect them. So as far as the continuing education goes, like I said, just building upon those fundamental skills, keeping them sharp. You mentioned earlier, you know, firefighting. Yes, we have seen a decline in fires. So that's what we would call one of those low-frequency, high-risk type of fires. So you go into a burning building, and that's obviously low-frequency. It doesn't happen very often, but the risk is extremely high. So that's where we as individual firefighters and departments need to determine, do we have adequate resources there at the time of the emergency to put ourselves in harm's way? Is there a savable life in that house? Or if there isn't, do we just – you know, this is going to be a defensive operation. We don't have the resources to mitigate this problem. So let's stay back, keep ourselves safe. And that's a tough call to make. But, you know, that's where training comes into play. You know, above and beyond firefighter training, you know, you have officers who are leading your organization, your company officers, your captains, your lieutenants, your chief officers, which require additional training to help make those very difficult decisions.
You know, the training across departments varies, though. We're talking about 235 departments around the state or so, and, you know, varying levels of ability to have somebody as experienced as you mentioned do lead the training, or what kind of training there is, and whether or not most of the members of the department can show up for those training sessions or will show up for them. So there seems like there's a possibility, at least, for real variability in the kind of training beyond the basics that members of departments around the state are getting. Do you think, or is it a concern for you, that there is this really sort of varying level of what different departments are trained and equipped to do around the state?
I think each individual department is knows what their community needs, and that's what they focus on as far as their training. Speaking of Bristol, we require our members to get annually for continuing education a minimum of 35 hours. But, you know, that's usually never an issue. You know, some people average about 75 to 100 hours a year. They're just very committed, and there's so many opportunities above and beyond your departmental training to get continuing education. We have our annual Addison County Regional Fire School coming up the weekend of April 23rd and 24th. You know, instructors coming in from all over the state and all over the country to teach courses, teach these new skills so we can stay sharp and protect our communities.
But that's assuming that people are able to do that or have the willingness or the time, which is not the case in every department, I would imagine.
I think everybody's commitment varies. Like any organization, it doesn't matter what type of organization you're in. It could be the fire service, it could be your local legion, but you always have those, that group who goes above and beyond, and you have those who, you know, were there and they meet the minimum requirements because perhaps that's all they're able to give because of the stresses from home or from their job. You know, they have families, other commitments. So it's definitely a challenge, which is why recruitment and retention is so important.
There was a situation recently in Georgia, Vermont, where 7 members of the department were dismissed by the town or resigned. And officials say it's because they didn't sign a new confidentiality agreement. Some of it seems to be related to the town and to the department's social media policy and confidentiality policy. But several of the dismissed members say they fear they can't actually speak out about safety issues, and that's one of their main concerns. Brett LaRose, is there a risk that because these departments are volunteer from top to bottom, you know, from chief down to trainees, that it can be hard to set rules or boundaries or standards and expect everybody to follow them?
It's certainly challenging to implement them, but I think they're definitely needed. We're professional volunteer firefighters. We don't collect a paycheck, but we're expected to do the same job as someone who does collect a paycheck. You know, it's, someone once told me, you're essentially volunteering for an organization, but you're volunteering to, you know, follow the organization's guidelines or standards or the town's policies that are in place, and those are in place for a reason, and it typically comes down to safety, to protect you and to protect the town.
Ken Canning is Director of Risk Management Services for the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, and he's on the line with us right now. Hi, Ken. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah. Hi, Jane. Thanks for inviting me on the program.
I wanted to ask you, because this is part of one of the things that you deal with in helping volunteer departments make sure that they have the equipment that's needed, the safety features that are needed. How do we fund all of this for volunteer departments? Some of them are actual departments of a town, and they're basically paid for by taxpayers every year. Regardless of whether the department is or not, there's probably some additional fundraising that's going on. But what do you do in helping departments make sure that they have everything they need?
Sure. Well, the Vermont League of Cities and Towns is a nonprofit association owned collectively by all of Vermont's cities, towns, and villages. So one of the programs we offer to our members is called the Property and Casualty Intermunicipal Fund. So it's like a self-insurance program for Vermont municipalities. And we offer insurance and risk management programs. So we're firm believers of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So we have a grant program that's a 50-50 matching grant for safety equipment, and we'll fund, you know, up to $5,000 to help many municipal departments, including fire, rescue, and ambulance, purchase safety-related equipment.
And they take you up on that pretty frequently?
Oh, sure. The board of directors of the PASIF program, that's Property and Casualty Intermunicipal Fund, started this program in 2010, and since that time has awarded $1.2 million in equipment to our members. And of that, about $435,000 has gone to municipal fire, rescue, and ambulance departments.
That's Ken Canning with the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. Ken, thank you very much for sharing that info. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So, Brett LaRose, as we wrap up here, you know, one of the things that we've mentioned a couple times is that idea of retainment and having enough people in a department to respond to calls. You know, we're talking about people with day jobs that they may not be able to leave, and there's mutual aid, so you can call in other town departments if something is large or if you're not getting enough of a response. But from your perspective now, 21 years in tomorrow, how would you redesign the system, or looking to the future, how do you think we could tweak the system to make it work really well on into the future?
Well, first of all, Bristol is one of 17 fire departments in the Addison County Firefighters Association. We have a very strong mutual aid system in Addison County. But looking to the future, you know, this is just my personal opinion, but I believe in order for the fire service and rural communities to stay viable, we need to think about doing things differently. You know, fire trucks cost a lot of money. The equipment we put on our firefighters, a lot of money. You know, the pancake breakfasts, our raffle dinners we do, you know, those are great public relations events. But in the big picture, they don't make the kind of money you need to replace a fire truck. And so I think we need to rethink how we do things in rural communities, consolidation, sharing resources, you know, and the fire service is based on tradition, and change is hard. But I think in order for us to be fiscally responsible, that's something, you know, we as a state, you know, as a country, as a state, as towns need to really look at moving forward.
Does that mean regionalization, fewer departments?
Whatever it may look like, regionalization, certainly a term, you know, I would throw out there. But again, it's consolidation, sharing resources, because if we continue to duplicate resources where they're not needed, we could fund ourselves, tax ourselves right out of business.
Brett LaRose is the president of the Addison County Firefighters Association and chief of the Bristol Fire Department. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a dystopian novel where extremely old people steal the brains of children. In our monthly book club for kids, we head to Marlboro, where students are reading The One Safe Place by author Tanya Unsworth. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and now it's time for Dorothy's List, our series about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Each month during the school year, we visit with middle grade students reading one of the books. This month, VPR's Amy Noyce takes us to Marlboro, where students are reading The One Safe Place by author Tanya Unsworth.
I wanted to talk to Garrett. No. Library time at the Marlborough School is something of an oasis in the midst of a hectic school day. Students in this reading group are serving each other tea and cupcakes and getting ready to settle into their discussion of The One Safe Place. The novel is set in a future where the world is hot and inhospitable, and water is a precious commodity. Seventh grader Lily Hillenberg starts by summarizing the plot. As she explains, the main character, Devin, is left alone on his farm after his grandfather dies, and he finds he can't take care of the entire farm on his own.
So he sets off to the city where his grandfather told him to go if he ever needs extra help. So he sets free all of the animals, and he goes off to find the city, and on his way there, he notices how different the world is compared to his farm. So he gets to the city, and it's very dry there, and he tries to talk to people, but they just ignore him.
The city is teeming with orphaned kids living on the streets. After a rough night on his own, Devin meets a girl named Kit, who shows him the ropes. There are rumors of a place where only the luckiest kids get to go, a place where children can have all the water, food, and toys they want, and they have a chance to get adopted. Kit says the rumor isn't true, until one day Devin is invited to go. He brings Kit with him to the Gabriel H. Penn Home for Childhood. Once Devin and Kit get to the home, they get a tour from a boy named Luke. Devin notices something is off with some of the other children, and many of them don't seem happy, despite living in what seems like a paradise. When they get to a large gym, Devin notices some other people acting strangely, too. Author Tanya Unsworth takes it from there in this passage from The One Safe Place.
"Who are they?" he asked Luke. "What are they doing?" The reason they were all so still, he now realized, was because they were extremely old, older than he imagined it was possible to be. Time had withered them to scraps held together by cobwebs and spittle. Only their eyes, glittering slightly, showed that there was life inside their brittle husks. One or two stood leaning against sticks. The rest were sitting in wheelchairs, their shrunken faces surrounded by pillows. On each face was a look of utter concentration. He suddenly noticed another thing. Just a few moments ago, when they'd passed through the gym, none of the children were moving very much. But now they appeared in a fever of animation. They were running to climb the ropes. A few had already managed to get into the harnesses and were swooping to and fro, screaming and whooping. The eyes of the old people passed slowly, very slowly, from one child to another. "Who are they?" Devin repeated. "They're the visitors," Luke said.
The kids think the visitors are there to adopt them, but the truth is something far more sinister. The visitors are choosing a child to swap minds with for a little while so they can experience childhood again. But there's something different about Devin's mind, as librarian Rochelle Garfinkel discusses with her students.
He sees sounds and hears colors.
And can memorize numbers and like colors.
He can like taste colors.
Anybody remember what it's called?
Synesthesia.
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 After reading The One Safe Place, this group of Marlborough students has some questions for author Tanya Unsworth. First up is seventh grader Cyrus Burt.
Are the things at the home your idea of a utopia?
I think they are a kind of utopia, but they're the utopia that an adult might imagine would be suitable for a child. So the home has been sort of created to present a kind of paradise for childhood so that these old people can swap their minds with children and go to this kind of paradise where everything that they imagine is fun about childhood is there. So it's a kind of adult idea of what would make a child happy. And obviously, it's not a utopia at all because it's missing the one thing that really does make children happy, which is, you know, love and security and true, you know, safety. It has the appearance of a utopia. But of course, you know, it's the opposite of that.
Seventh grader Niamh Whitehouse wonders how the author came up with such a concept.
What was your inspiration for the book, The One Safe Place?
It's hard to remember, but I think it came when I went to the dentist one day. And I really don't like going to the dentist, like a lot of people. And I was sitting in the waiting room and I suddenly thought, wouldn't it be great if I could take my mind somewhere else? Not in my imagination, but literally somewhere else. I thought it would be fantastic to be able to swap minds with someone who was having a really good day. And then when all the horrible, nasty stuff had been done on my teeth, I could swap minds again and be back in my body and it would all be over and done with. And I just kept thinking about this and thinking how great it would be. And then I also thought, well, it would also really be actually terrible if we could do that.
Seventh grader Samantha Mills had this observation about the adult characters in The One Safe Place.
As I read the book, I noticed that the authority / adult figures weren't very responsible and weren't nice to the children. And I was wondering what made you choose that about all the adult characters and why there wasn't at least one character that was kind and sweet and loved children.
Well, that's a really good question. And you're right. The adults are pretty awful. I'm not sure why I made them all awful. I do have one adult character who is very nice, although he doesn't appear in the book. He's really only in Devon's memory, and that's his grandfather, who has raised him with love. And later on in the book, when Devon gets into difficulty, he sort of hears his grandfather's voice in his head telling him to be strong and hold on to himself and remember who he is. So the grandfather was a sort of positive adult in the book. But you're right, the rest are absolutely disgraceful. And I have no excuse for that. I think when I was a kid, I kind of thought that lots of grown-ups were kind of evil. So maybe that was part of it.
Seventh grader Broden Walsh has our next question.
I was wondering how you knew that older people yearn for their childhood back. Did you get this information through interviews, personal experiences, a guess, or is it just fiction?
I think actually that's one of the best questions about this book that I've ever been asked. How do I know that adults want to get their childhood back? Well, I'm an adult myself, and I had a very happy childhood, and as I was coming out of it, I was quite aware that it was passing. I don't know if other children have that feeling around the age of 11 or 12, that things are changing and feel sad about it. And I wanted to get older, but I also felt sad. And that feeling of sadness kind of stayed with me a little tiny bit into being an adult. And I think that perhaps, you know, in the back of their heads, a lot of adults kind of yearn for that time when you're really innocent and young and you don't have too many problems and you see the world in a certain way. And that's something you kind of carry through your whole of your life, I think.
Student Moreau Rosner wonders how the author would feel if she were in her character's shoes.
Would you appreciate the home if you were in their position but knew the consequences?
I think, you know, if I was a kid in that situation, you know, just like the other kids, to begin with, the home would seem like a refuge because life outside was so tough. And to begin with, all I would be able to think about was the fact that there's food there and water and company. But I think very quickly I would want out of it. I think if I'd known beforehand, I wouldn't go, to be honest, because what it does to the kids' heads is really, really bad and sort of irreversible. And yeah, I'm not sure I'd have gone in there.
The dystopia that Tanya Unsworth creates in The One Safe Place forces the reader to imagine dark elements of humanity. But fortunately for these Marlborough School students, they can reflect on those concepts of selfishness and survival in the oasis of their school library, complete with tea, snacks, and stimulating literary discussions. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is The One Safe Place by Tanya Unsworth, thanks to librarian Rochelle Garfinkel at the Marlborough School. Kids around the state are voting right now to decide which book will win the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. Ask your school or town librarian for information on how your child can participate. The voting deadline is April 25th. And next month on Dorothy's List, we'll reveal this year's winner and we'll get a preview of some of the books nominated for next year's award. Dorothy's List is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. Tomorrow on the program, the struggle over funding for the Vermont State College System. We'll look at public higher education in Vermont and put it in the context of how other states across the nation are dealing with these issues. Send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.